listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello there, and welcome to another classic replay from the Unbelievable podcast. We've been bringing you these conversations that matter for over 15 years now, and got a really good one for you today. This was atheist Cambridge philosopher Arif Ahmed, who went head-to-head with New Zealand-based Christian philosopher Glenn Peoples back in October 2010, I think it was, a classic debate on the moral argument for God today. And don't forget, you can keep up to date with the latest from the show. You can get in touch and find many more of these debates on big questions at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Well, thank you, gentlemen, both, for coming in today and joining
you.
Me on the program.
Glenn,
thanks for joining us again. You are from New Zealand.
Absolutely.
Do New Zealand people get really annoyed when they get confused with Australians?
We've grown rather immune to it. I think it happens often enough, especially when, you know, especially from Americans for some reason, they have a habit of confusing the two.
Well, I've bumped into many people from New Zealand over here in the UK. You seem to be more of you outside New Zealand than inside New Zealand.
That's probably true. Interestingly, it's probably true in Australia.
Well, you have a lot of interest in philosophy. You've done a PhD. Is this something you'd like to kind of have as a full-time career? Would that be the kind of the idea?
Absolutely,
is that what you're aiming for?
I graduated in 2008, so not that long ago, and I'm definitely in the process of looking for some sort of academic role involving my interest. I currently work for the tax department in New Zealand. But I take some courage.
So you're one of the baddies, eh?
Well, no, I take some courage. You know, Jesus said that tax collectors and prostitutes are entering the kingdom of heaven ahead of the religious people. So I'm okay.
Well, there you go. As I said, you run this blog, a popular blog, beretta-online.com is the web address. But the title of the blog, as it were, is Say Hello to My Little Friend.
That's right.
Primarily discussing religious issues, philosophical issues, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it discusses anything that interests me, which primarily means theology and philosophy, occasionally a bit of, you know, social issues and politics, but mostly theology and philosophy, and as those two things intersect with each other.
Fantastic. We were talking last time about physicalism. This time we're going to be talking about the moral argument. So we'll come back to you in a moment, if it were, to get from you what you conceive that argument to be.
Sure.
And it'll be interesting to develop that with our other guest who joins me on the programme today, Arif Ahmed. Arif, thank you very much for coming on the programme today.
Hello, thank you for having me.
You've come down from Cambridge, where you are a lecturer and tutor in philosophy.
That's right.
Do you find that there's a lot of interest from your graduates looking to explore these kinds of issues? Is it still as popular as it ever was, philosophy?
I think philosophy as a subject is probably increasingly popular. I mean, it's more popular now than it was 10 years ago, more popular 10 years ago than it was 20 years ago. So it's becoming more popular. I think partly the reason for that, I think, is because philosophy, at least as it's taught in some of the better departments in the UK and the United States, give students skills not just to go on into academic work, but a variety of analytical skills that are useful in all kinds of jobs. Moving on to the subject of religion itself, I think philosophy of religion is one of the most popular parts of our syllabus, in my experience, partly because it's something on which everybody has an opinion already, and partly because it's something that generates such heated debate.
It does, doesn't it? Very often in the confines of this studio as well. But I'd be interested to know your own background. Was it, as it were, philosophical reflection that led you to a position of atheism? Did you subscribe to any religious beliefs before that?
Well, I did. I mean, it was philosophical reflection in the loose sense of that expression that led me away from it. So I was brought up by parents who were Muslim. And I was brought up in Islam, but my parents were liberal-minded enough to send me to a Christian school, a Methodist school. And I rejected religion of all sorts, probably at around the age of maybe 14 or 15, largely as a result of exposure to empirical method, which is something that still used to be taught in British schools in those days. I don't know whether it still is. Nevertheless, I do have some respect for Methodism in particular. It taught me values that I think are still important, such as industry and discipline and honesty. So I wouldn't say that I despise all religions. I just think that their doctrines are false.
Okay. It's a straw poll, really, but whenever I get philosophers in, I quite often ask, in your opinion, are most philosophers you come across atheists? And is there any correlation between being a philosopher and being an atheist?
My own experience is that most philosophers in the Western tradition are atheists or agnostics. But amongst philosophers, I wouldn't say that there is a correlation between being a good philosopher and being an atheist. That is to say, there are many very able philosophers who are religious, and there are many very bad philosophers who are atheists. But the converse is true as well. There are many very good philosophers.
Well, which one are you, I wonder, Glenn? Are you a very good
well,
Christian
let philosopher? History judge me, but I try to be a good one.
What do you think? I mean, I when I went up to university and did philosophy as part of my degree, some of my Christian friends cast a slightly worried look in my direction, thinking, oh, is he going to, you know, be influenced away from Christian belief? Do you feel that there's any danger of that when young people go to university, perhaps from a Christian background? And
no, not in the least. I mean, people being what they are, I mean, they like to have their own positions affirmed. And, I mean, my experience is that if you go into a philosophy department really, you know, strongly believing a certain set of beliefs, the most likely outcome is that you're going to use the resources of philosophy to defend those beliefs. That's what tends to happen in my experience anyway.
And you came to philosophy sort of as an area you really came to enjoy.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm one of those sick people who just can't get enough of the stuff.
But as a Christian, did you sort of arrive at it with a set of Christian beliefs and then have, as you said, you know, used it to kind of, as it were, show why you believe
Christianity
is...
Yeah, I mean, we all arrive with our baggage. Now, that's not to say that, you know, Christians are not willing to listen to arguments against their position, but, you know, for obvious reasons, I'm still here. I didn't find any particular reason to abandon Christian faith, and I think that there are good reasons for espousing Christian faith. I mean, the argument that we're going to be talking about today isn't specifically a Christian argument. It's just an argument for theism or against, you know, the denial of theism, if you like.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, Arif today finds belief in God unbelievable, and it's the converse from Glenn. Glenn, tell me, the moral argument for God, I'll try and explain what I think that is, and then why don't you tell me how I've got it wrong and what it actually is.
Or not.
Or not. But essentially, I think it goes something like this. Most people are happy to accept that there are objective moral values that exist, that killing babies is wrong, whether at any time, in any place, that is not something that depends on a culture you live in, whether it's right or wrong, that right and wrong really does exist. If that is true, then that must exist, if you like, beyond just our own existence, if you like. It's not something that arises out of evolution or something like that. There is, in fact, there must be a moral lawgiver for things to be actually right and wrong. It can't be dependent simply on what we happen to believe or not believe about right and wrong. Is that sort of...
That's a fair representation of how the argument is popularly perceived, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but that's kind of the street-level version of the argument. I mean, basically what you're saying there is if God did not exist, then there couldn't be any moral facts, you know, real facts. But there are moral facts, and so God must exist, basically. I don't think it's all that persuasive. I mean, I think it's sound in that I do believe each of those premises is true, and I think the conclusion follows, but it's not all that persuasive. I mean, obviously someone, or a lot of people do, in fact, dispute the first premise, that if God didn't exist and there couldn't be any moral facts. They say, well, that's not true. Some people also dispute the second premise. You know, they don't believe that there are any moral facts, and a number of atheists have gone that way. So I think the argument can be reformulated in a way that it's a bit more persuasive and a bit more nuanced, and it's reformulated in such a way that you could, in theory, accept the argument even if you don't believe there are any moral facts.
Okay.
Now, I construe the argument like this. If there are moral facts, then they have a basis, and their basis is either natural or supernatural, where supernatural just means non-natural. So these categories are mutually exclusive and cover all bases. Number two, the basis of moral facts is not natural. Number three, which follows, therefore, if there are moral facts, then their basis is supernatural. Then I go on to number four. The most plausible way to think of a supernatural basis of moral facts is in terms of a supernatural person who brings moral facts about. And the conclusion, therefore, if there are moral facts, then the most plausible way to think of their basis is in terms of a supernatural person who brings moral facts about. So that's the version of the moral argument that I espouse.
Okay, and what would a moral fact be, for instance? Give us a, you know...
It would be wrong for me to take this pen and leap over the desk and stab you in the eye.
But very often people will say, well, there might be a circumstance in which that's right, because if my eye had just developed a terrible infection and you're stabbing it, would that save my whole body?
Yeah, okay, we'd have to make the fact a bit more nuanced then. Unless there is some benefit to you in my doing so, it would be wrong for me to jump over this table and stab you in the eye. People would normally accept that something like that is a moral fact.
Okay. And most people live their lives, as it were, kind of along those lines, that you doing that to me is not fair. You coming and robbing everything in my house is not fair, not because, you know, it's just a pain to me, but because it's actually wrong to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, I ought not do it.
Okay. Let's bring in Arif now. Arif, what do you make of the argument that that Glenn's just outlined there? Perhaps starting with, do you believe in these so-called moral facts? Do you think there are moral facts that exist independently, if you like, of us?
Okay, good. So the argument, as I understand it, is one that purports to show that if there are moral facts, then they have a supernatural basis. Together with the assumption that there are moral facts, it implies that there's a supernatural basis for them. Moving on to the premise that there are moral facts, if we're going to take that as a premise for any sort of moral argument for the existence of God, I know that it's a minority view, but I find myself uncomfortable with the assumption that there are moral facts. That is to say, I'm not aware of any evidence for them, the evidence being the evidence of my senses, that being the only sort of evidence that I'd accept, senses and reasoning. I can't see in that any source for believing in moral facts. Now, you might say, well, how do I live my life then? What do I do?
Are you an immoral person?
Am I an immoral person? But it's, moral conduct is quite compatible with the denial of moral facts. You might hold the view, for instance, that we all have various preferences as to how to treat other people and how other people should treat other people and so on. These preferences can be explained. They've arisen perhaps in a manner that admits of evolutionary explanation and so on. I have these preferences as strongly as anyone else, so I'll campaign against various things that I think are immoral. That is to say that I prefer not to happen, and I campaign for things that I prefer to happen. This may include, for instance, the eradication of poverty or various other things. So moral conduct, the first thing I would say is that there's no evidence for believing in moral facts, and the second thing I would say is that that's quite compatible with leading a moral life.
Okay. Glenn.
Yeah. I don't think it's true to say that the conduct being described is moral conduct, or that the life being lived is a moral life. I mean, you might decide upon a model wherein what you desire is to have a decent proportion of your preferences satisfied, and you desire to see that satisfied in other people. Well, what you have then is satisfaction conduct. There is a natural fact being discussed, that is the fact of satisfaction. But to say that it is moral then imposes some kind of normative framework on it, like, I should actually treat other people this way. Well, who says you should treat them in the way that you wish to be treated? Now, I agree that you should, but the brute fact that producing them in a certain way brings about certain consequences is not itself normative. It's merely descriptive.
When it comes to, for instance, another society doing things which you don't agree with, if child sacrifice is what happens in another country that doesn't share your same moral standards because they prefer doing it and you don't prefer doing it, do you have any moral right or obligation to interfere with that and say that's wrong? Because would that just be you insisting on your preferences over their preferences?
Ultimately, it would be me insisting on my preferences over their preferences, but I would indeed insist on them. That is to say, I could hold the view that there are no moral facts while still believing that we ought to interfere with other people who are doing things that I prefer them not to do. So the universality of the application of my preferences is quite compatible with the denial of any objective moral facts of the sort that could be supported by empirical evidence.
I noticed that the word ought sprung up there. I mean, the view that it's just me imposing my preferences upon them is compatible with the view that I ought to do so. What do you mean when you say you ought to do so?
When you say you ought to do so, aren't you thereby imposing by the back door a kind of moral duty?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm partaking in language which, strictly speaking, I would want to be expunged for the sake of philosophical hygiene. You don't have to put any of it in terms of describing it as moral duty. If you think there are no moral facts, indeed you're obliged not to. You're obliged to describe it in some other terms. So what I would say is what matters is that I treat other people with generosity, I'm kind to other people, I'm concerned about the poor, and all of these other things.
Again, why does that matter? I mean, doesn't matter have a similar kind of intention to ought, I suppose?
Yes, I suppose you could say, well, if matters means matters in some sense other than the satisfaction of people's preferences, then obviously it's a term that I would not want to use. But I don't see why it has to be construed in that way.
I guess my problem is, well, what if the Nazis had won, you know, and had managed to spread the word around everywhere that Jewish people really were inferior and deserved to be gassed? Would their preferences, being the overriding preferences, be the ones that we should honour, or should a small minority who didn't believe that sort of act on their, you know, instinct that, no, this is wrong? Is it just about preferences, and whose preferences are the greater?
Well, obviously, it's a consequence of my position that I don't think... Well, there are two things. One thing is that, of course, I don't think that morality is to be equated with a majority preference. If I think there are no moral facts, I can't think that. So it's a consequence of my position that I don't think that. So there's no logical connection that I can see between the view that moral facts don't exist on the one hand, and the view that the majority's preference defines morality on the other. Those are two logically independent
positions.
Because
nothing defines morality.
Yeah, that's right. You could consistently hold, as I say, it seems to me, I hold this position not because I particularly like to hold it, because I find myself particularly comfortable with it, but it seems that the evidence drives me towards it.
Yeah, I mean, it suggests to me that it's impossible to prefer the wrong thing. I mean, if we just say that morality is a linguistic artifact and we can take out all the traditional content that was formerly signified by that artifact and pour into it nothing more than what we prefer, then it's impossible to be wrong about what the right thing to do is. It is impossible to prefer the wrong thing. My preferences are literally supreme. Now, I might not get my way because other people might manage to, you know, successfully force their preferences upon me and prevent me from having my way, but it's just impossible to be wrong about what the right thing to do is, if Arif is correct.
Let me kind of get this back to the issue of God, because at the moment you're kind of denying one of the fundamental premises here, Arif,
yes.
Which
mm.
is that moral facts exist. So in a way, do you feel you know, your job now, if you like, Glenn, to convince Arif that moral facts do exist and that therefore God exists? Or are you prepared to let him have his non-moral universe, amoral universe?
To be honest, I feel a bit torn. It's a bit torn. I mean, which way should I go? There is a sense in which I want to say to other atheists, look at Arif. You know, Arif is consistent. Why aren't you consistent? But, you know, the reality is there are a large number of atheists who have a real problem with what Arif is saying. People like Walter Sinnott Armstrong, who goes to great lengths to argue that you can have moral facts in the absence of God, or like Sam Harris, who I'll be discussing another time in the near future. I think it's enormously counterintuitive. And I would also say that we need to be careful what we mean when we say evidence, because if we describe evidence in such a way that the only kind of evidence that counts is evidence that can be experienced via the senses, then we would end up saying that logical proofs are not evidence, which strikes me as absurd. Now, it seems to me that if you come up with a position that seems enormously counterintuitive and leads to a number of consequences that seem implausible, that itself counts as evidence. For example, if you come up with a position that there is no factual basis for declaring, say, torture for fun wrong, then you should say to yourself, you know, it's just possible that I've made a wrong turn somewhere. I shouldn't be concluding this.
What do you think? I mean, I have had atheists on the programme who have wanted to say, yes, there are objective morals, because they just don't like the idea that there really is nothing objectively wrong, if you like, with torturing babies for fun or whatever other despicable thing you could come up with. Because intuitively, we want that to be a fact of the matter, don't we? And so... Are you not at all torn there, Arif, that you really would like these moral facts to be facts about the universe we live in? Or are you sort of, well, that's the way it is and you just got to kind of get on with it, basically?
Okay, good. Thank you. There's three things I want to say in regard to what you said and to what Glenn said. The first thing is that the view that only the senses are the source of evidence is compatible with saying that logical arguments can be a source of evidence if you think that logic itself has an empirical justification, which I happen to do. So there are sophisticated empiricist views, like the view of Quine, for instance. W.V. Quine was a philosopher who flourished in the mid-20th century, and his version of empiricism is more or less the one that I accept. In a nutshell, it says that theories are confirmed as a whole, not sentence by sentence, and in consequence of that, logic itself admits of empirical confirmation. So you could certainly hold the empiricist view that evidence resides in the senses, whilst also holding the view that logical arguments can be convincing and can count as a source of evidence. The second thing I would say is that Glenn mentioned the other premise of the argument, or of the moral argument as you initially stated it, which is that if moral facts exist, then God must exist. I think I'm tempted to deny that premise as well.
Right.
We haven't yet moved on to discussion of that premise, which I'd like to discuss.
Yeah, sure,
I'm tempted to deny that premise as well. I know there are people who accept my view who accept that premise, and there are people who reject that premise but who think there are moral facts. My own view tends to be that both of those premises are false. The third thing I'd want to say is that I don't count intuition. I do count rational deduction, and I do count the testimony of the senses as a form of evidence. I don't count intuition as evidence, partly because I'm not entirely sure what intuition is, if it isn't just one's prejudices. The fourth thing I'd like to say in response to your question was that, yes, I'd very much like it to be true that there were moral facts. I wish there were. But show me the evidence.
Okay. I suppose it is one of those things which, if you believe in moral facts, it has to come from somewhere where you just have to believe it, because you can't countenance the idea that there isn't a kind of objective form of morality.
If that means you wouldn't like it, you don't have to believe something just because you'd like it to be true.
Yeah, what do you make of that, Glenn?
It seems to me that when people react to scenarios like torture for fun or what have you, and I use extreme examples because they're the easiest ones to see, it's not that they look at it and say, you know, I'd really like it to be true that that's wrong. That's not what they're doing. What they're saying is, it seems to me that that really is wrong. Now, as for the question of we can't rely on intuitions just because we don't know what they are, that statement isn't true. It's not the case that we can't rely on something just because we don't know what it is. I mean, a million years ago, when beings didn't know anything about auditory systems or how they worked or how the eye works or how the brain works, that didn't mean that they couldn't believe in things that they saw on the basis of eyesight, even though they didn't know what eyesight was. So it's false to say that we can't rely on conclusions delivered to us by a certain set of faculties unless we have a full and satisfying account of those faculties. In other words, what I'm offering is an epistemology called reliabilism. That so long as you have a reliable intuitive faculty about morality, and provided that faculty is giving you reliable results, then you can trust what you experience. Now, the same is true of sense perception in general. I mean, there's no non-question begging way of, say, accounting for the fact that we can rely on our senses. But given a sensible, reliabilist epistemology, we do it anyway, and we're justified in doing so. And that was true before we knew anything at all about how our senses worked.
I suppose my ultimate question as well is going back to this whole thing about the moral relativity of the world that you therefore inhabit, Arif, in the sense that, although you said, well, it doesn't boil down to, you know, the majority's preferences, but isn't that ultimately what will enforce, what will be the moral code, if you like? And that if we had evolved in a way that everyone now in the UK believed that, you know, rape was fine or something like that, that would just be the way the world is, and it's not something we should try to strive against, because it's actually just a case that everyone has that preference, but there's no sense of ought, that it ought not to be that way, in your worldview.
Nothing in my position implies that it's permissible not to strive against rape, for instance, or any other sort of activity, because nothing in my position implies that anything is permissible. You also need to separate two questions. One of them is the question of how people ought to behave. There's the question of whether there are any moral facts and what they imply about how people ought to behave. And the other one is the question about how people do in fact behave. And it may indeed be unsurprising that Western civilization has grown up and existed, and all the facts about cooperation that entails, that may indeed be unsurprising for evolutionary reasons. So the fact that we live in a society in which there isn't general crime and civil war and so on owes something, I think, to that. It also probably owes something to the existence of a body with a monopoly on violence, namely the government. If such a body didn't exist, probably there would be a great deal more activity of the sort that I wouldn't myself want to see going on.
We are going to have to take a quick break. Time has run away with us already.
Yes, it does.
And we're going to have to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment's time, continuing this discussion between Glenn Peoples, our Christian philosopher, and Arif Ahmed, our atheist philosopher, on the moral argument for God. And perhaps in the next section, gentlemen, we'll kind of move on to that other aspect of the argument that you mentioned there, Arif. You know, well, if they did exist, would that therefore be proof that God exists? And we can sort of go on that one a little bit. You're listening to another philosophical edition of Unbelievable. Find us online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable, and we'll be back again in just a couple of minutes' time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
We're looking at one of the many arguments that exist for the existence of God, the moral argument today, and to help us to pick out some of the various aspects of it and to debate it, Glenn Peoples is with me. He's a New Zealand Christian philosopher. He runs the blog Say Hello to My Little Friend, where he discusses issues about religion, Christianity and philosophy. That's at beretta-online.com. Arif Ahmed is an atheist philosopher from Cambridge. He's done debates in this sort of area before. And we're asking today, do things like objective moral values exist? Well, we've debated whether they exist in the first place just now. But, well, what if they do exist, as many people do believe they exist? Does their existence require a moral lawgiver, a.k.a. God? That's sort of the way that the argument runs. And we'll let sort of Glenn and Arif explain for themselves where it goes from here. Okay, gentlemen, so putting yourself, as it were, in the position of one who perhaps, you know, yeah. if they did exist, do you see the next step of Glenn's argument as valid, that the next several steps, I suppose, that ultimately we have to concede that there is a moral lawgiver, if you like?
As it stands, and logically, the argument, which has the premise that there are moral facts, and the conclusion that God exists, or some supernatural basis for those facts exists, is formally invalid. So you'd have to add some other premises in order to get from that premise validly to the conclusion.
As I think Glenn sort of does.
So it would be interesting to know what those premises are. Prima facie, you might think that the argument fails simply because you could consistently hold that the premise is true and the conclusion is false in the following way. You might take the view, for instance, that what's morally obligatory or what's morally permissible is a matter of whether your conduct causes harm to other people, let's say, and that would be a very straightforward moral system. You say it's simply a matter of whether it causes harm to other people, and your moral obligations are not to do things that cause gratuitous harm to other people, for instance. Now, that's obviously a very crude basis for morality, but it's sufficient to make the point. There's nothing in that I can see by itself that implies the existence of somebody who makes those requirements or produces those requirements. So it's often said that because it's normative, that is, because it says something not about how the world is, but about how, or something non-moral about how the world is, but about how we ought to act, there should be some lawgiver or requirer who places those requirements.
Where did it come from?
Where did it come from? That's right. There are plenty of non-moral requirements, it seems to me, that don't require lawgivers or requirers. The standard example is logical obligations. So there's an obligation upon us to have consistent beliefs, for instance. That is, you can't believe both that today is Tuesday and that today is Wednesday. There's a requirement on us not to believe both of those things, but clearly that's a requirement that wasn't produced by anybody, or that had no, you know, there was no person who laid it down. Logical requirements seem to be requirements that exist without a lawgiver, so it's not clear why.
It depends on who you talk to. I just did a programme on Christian presuppositionalism, presuppositional apologetics, in which case
they would say,
actually, you do need God even in that circumstance. But that's a different issue. We won't go into that.
I'd be interested to see the argument for thinking that.
You'd be there quite a long time. There's a very, very long thread on it on our forum of this programme online. But you're saying, as far as you can see, there's no kind of in the same way that you wouldn't see a step from the laws of logic to God exists, you don't see the same thing for moral facts.
I don't see that the existence of logical obligations of rational norms requires the existence of a great logician who lays them down. And so I'm not clear what the difference is in the moral case, why the existence of moral norms should require the existence of a great moralist.
Glenn.
Right. I think there is a difference to be had. I mean, people find fault with someone who, say, draws an invalid logical inference, but not because they think that person is somehow wicked or that there is something substandard about that person as a decent person. We would just think, well, you've failed in this particular task. Whereas if someone said, look, I just see nothing wrong with torturing babies, we wouldn't think, well, hang on, you've made an error here. We would think there is something actually deficient about you. It's not that you've theorized improperly, although you may have done that, but there is something about us that ought not to be this way. I mean, not all normativity, of course, requires, you know, the existence of God. For example, laws that we pass in our own countries are normative in some fairly obvious sense, but they require certain types of conduct, and so they say, you know, in order to be a proper citizen of this country, in order to behave as citizens of this country are meant to behave, you will follow these rules. And I think that's a pretty analogous one, because as citizens of the universe, as citizens of existence, we believe that there are certain things which ought not to be done, or we are not good specimens of humanity, good specimens of the inhabitants of the universe. So I think there are different ways that we see rules about conduct in general and, say, rules about maths or spelling or logic.
Well, I can see that there are analogies on either side. So, for instance, you might think that the existence of legal obligations requires the existence of some person or some body that makes the laws. So, you know, I'm legally obliged not to drive over a certain speed on the motorway, and that's because there was, you know, the Parliament laid it down that doing so is illegal. On the other hand, I'm obliged to have consistent beliefs, but that's not because anybody laid it down that I'm obliged to have consistent beliefs. The whole question is whether moral norms are similar to the legal norms or whether they're similar to the rational norms.
Well, I don't see that you are obliged to have consistent beliefs.
Well, it seems to be there's a rational obligation to have consistent beliefs.
But on pain of what are you obliged to have consistent beliefs?
On pain of some of them being false.
Well, that's not. Well, if that's all there is, then I don't see that it's normative if you simply describe it that way.
Well, you could describe moral norms in just the same way. On pain of being wicked, you shouldn't do this. On pain as pain of thinking something false, you shouldn't do that. The parallel seems to be precise.
The point is, on pain of not being what you were meant to be, and I think meant is the proper word there.
Well, if that means on pain of not being what I was meant by somebody to be, that's begging the question. If it means on pain of not being what I was meant to be in some other sense, I'd like to know what that other sense is. If it means on pain of being wicked, then the parallel with the rational norm is sustained.
Well, I don't know that there's much content to the word wicked if you take away the idea of there being some way that they were meant to be. But what I mean is...
But do you mean meant to be by someone or just meant to be in some other sense?
No, what I'm appealing to is the idea that there exists a proper function.
Yeah, that's just another way of saying what you were meant to be. And what I'm asking is it something you were meant to be by someone? Is that what you mean by a moral obligation, or do you just mean something else?
I mean, I think that's the only way to account for it, having some way that we are meant to be.
Yeah, but you can't build it into your definition
of
the term.
No, it's not built into the way that... Obviously, being meant to be a certain way by someone isn't built into the definition of being meant to be a certain way, but I think it's the only way to account for it.
Well, I'd like to know what else was meant by being meant to be. If the point is we can't explain the fact that you have these moral obligations without presupposing that there was someone who meant you to be this way.
Exactly.
Then the question, then we go back to my original objection, because there's no reason to suppose we have to explain the existence of rational norms by supposing that there was somebody who laid them down. So if the explanation isn't necessary in that case, why should it be necessary in the moral case?
Well, I guess the difference I see is one of normativity. I don't see that we are meant to, or that we are dysfunctional in any natural sense, when we don't see the logical conclusion of logical arguments.
Can I just kind of... Because you guys are going at hammer and tongs here. but I just wanted to clarify. You, at this point in this discussion, Arif, you're saying, OK, just in the same way that we don't have to have God in order to know that we can have logical conclusions, we don't have to have God in the picture for our, you know, moral facts to be a fact, if we grant them, okay. And you're saying at this point, Glenn, okay, but those two things are different because we don't consider someone in some sense deficient if they simply are making logical mistakes and aren't making the correct steps. Mm. Do you not like the idea that Arif is suggesting here, which is that there's no kind of essentially no difference between a moral fact and a logical kind of fact?
No, I think there is a difference. The difference is, I mean, I do believe in the concept of proper function for human beings, and so do a lot of atheists, but I think, of course, that the only genuine way to account for proper function is with appeal to theism.
When you say a proper function, do you mean...
That's what I've been referring to when I say, you know, being a good specimen of humanity, or being what we were meant to be, or functioning properly.
And is there any sense in which that has any meaning to you, to say that we are meant to function, we are meant to function in a certain way, or that when we are functioning properly, we are acting in a certain way? Does that make sense to you, Arif, as an atheist? Could you kind of contemplate that sense that there is a purpose, if you like, to because that essentially does invoke some kind of purpose to humans, doesn't it?
Okay, good. So there's a couple of things I'd like to say about this. The first thing is that, of course, I agree there's a difference. I'm not saying that rational norms are essentially the same, whatever essentially means. I'm not saying that they're identical to moral norms. The point is only that if you have inconsistent beliefs, then you're rationally deficient. If you do wicked things, then you're morally deficient. But if rational deficiency doesn't imply the existence of somebody who lays down the requirement, then it's not clear why moral deficiency should do so either. So there's a parallel between those two cases. Moving on to the question about purpose, I can't see any reason to believe that the existence of moral norms implies the existence of any proper behaviour or any fit behaviour for a human being in any sense that implies the existence of somebody who laid down those norms, which is, of course, what's at issue.
Yeah, so what you'd be talking about then, Arif, is not so much a proper function, but a useful function in order to get something.
Yes.
Yeah. So it does seem to me that I'm the one who's talking about the possibility of dysfunction, whereas you don't think there is really such a thing as dysfunction in that sense. All you think is a sense of, well, I'd rather it weren't that way.
Well, there's dysfunction in the sense relative to what you want out of something.
Which is just the same as saying, I wish it weren't that way.
Well, relative to what you want out of something can be functioning well or not. But there's no sense, that's right. I mean, I don't think there's any sense of saying human beings are functioning properly in a way that's fit for human beings as such, in any sense that implies the existence of somebody who laid down our function.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you have to think that way as an atheist, because if people want certain things, then certain behaviour becomes right in the sense of proper function. But you certainly can't say, well, he shouldn't desire that and he shouldn't behave that way to get towards that end. Because if he desires that, then it is proper for him to behave in a certain way to get towards that end, even if that end is, I don't know, a final solution.
Well, I can agree with you that, you know, there's no absolute sense, independently of what anyone wants, of what is the proper function for human beings that's laid down by another, that's laid down by some non-human being. I agree with you on that point. Are atheists committed to that view? I'm not sure. I think I hold it. I'm not sure whether atheism entails it.
I think atheism strongly entails it. I mean, I don't see how you can be an atheist and believe that there is a reason why. I mean, an epistemic reason why, you know, a forward-looking reason why the human race is here.
Well, you might think that the human race has purposes which are completely impersonal and nothing to do with the divine creator.
Well, then you would.
Communists believe that.
I mean, you wouldn't be talking about forward-looking reasons then.
Well, communists
reasons.
Believe that. They might think the purpose of the human race was to create the dictatorship of the proletariat. That's compatible with atheism.
Well, if that's genuinely what they believe, that the human race is for something, then no, I actually don't think it's compatible with atheism.
So you think that communists are not atheists?
They are indeed, but just because someone is an atheist, I mean, I think you're
an
atheist.
Communists
too.
Are committed to theism.
Yeah, I think you're committed to theism as well.
Right.
So,
well, that's because you think it's true. But
yeah.
Yeah, but the point is that I myself don't, but you could certainly hold the view that human beings exist for a certain purpose, which is entirely impersonal.
Which is entirely impersonal. So that there is a purpose beyond a human being's
beyond
own
the wants of any particular
individual.
That's right.
Now, Glenn, you're saying surely that must mean.
Yeah, I mean, I
don't believe that myself.
No,
but
you
I
don't.
Think it's
but
a position.
But you could be consistent and hold that.
Yeah, see, I don't think so, and that's just because of what I think a purpose is. I mean, I think purpose has to do with intentionality, and I don't think that an impersonal something can have intentionality.
I mean, given that you don't believe that any sense of purpose, Arif, some people may say, "Oh, that's a terribly bleak outlook." You know, that there's no purpose whatsoever, etc. Obviously, for you, you may want there to be purpose, but the fact is you don't see any evidence for purpose, etc., just in the way you don't see the same for moral values. But nonetheless, we all live our lives in a way in which we believe there is purpose and kind of a point and a kind of an end to which we're striving, a kind of level to which we aspire. We want society to do better. We want, you know, and everything else. But is this kind of... possibly why some people see atheism as essentially nihilistic, you know, that it's kind of so bleak that because there isn't actually anything out there that we're aiming for, we kind of, it's all kind of what we've made up on the hoof, really, and none of it actually makes any difference, ultimately. We'll all die at some point down the line in the heat death of the universe. You know, it's kind of just renders it all kind of pointless in the end. I don't know if you've got any...
Yeah, good. Well, there's two things I'd say about that. The first thing is that the fact, if it were one, that atheism implies the pointlessness of everything, isn't by itself a valid argument against atheism, because, of course, everything might well be pointless.
And I
That's
agree.
Something we might have to... That might be something we might just have to accept.
It's but, an emotional yeah, argument,
but
more than
yeah, that. So it's an emotional argument, so not one of the sort that I'm really trained to assess. But let me just say a little bit about it. I think people do often have a view, often very thoughtful and reflective people do have the view that if you don't have some sort of religious belief, then your life becomes meaningless, and life in general becomes pointless. But I don't think that that has to be true. People can certainly have their own values and their own aspirations. People can fight for things like social justice, or fight to decrease poverty, or do a variety of other things that are quite compatible with not thinking.
And I wouldn't dispute that for a second. All I'm saying is that I would question, and I don't know whether you would question this as well, Glenn, but whether, when they look at it, whether there's actually any underlying foundation for that, because
if
in a sense that's kind of where the argument is.
What you're getting at is any claim to there being an actual purpose for our being here will be a false claim, is what you're getting at.
Yeah, I suppose ultimately that is the way. I would never, you know, a lot of people do paint this as the moral argument for God as being, well, you can only be moral if you believe in God. I think
that's
a complete...
True. Yeah.
You know, that's nothing
that's
to
separate
do with
issue
what,
we're,
what
not,
we're
I mean,
talking
that's
about.
That's not the premise of this argument.
No, indeed.
And it's false.
But I think many people do confuse it sometimes with those two things, which are quite distinct, obviously. But I suppose ultimately the point is, I personally would rather live in a universe with moral facts than in a universe without them. So I'm kind of... On the balance, if it's just the evidence that I'm presented with, I kind of have to look at my own thoughts about the matter, and I can't sort of deny the kind of the moral facts that appear to be evident to me. I don't know. You say there's no evidence for these moral facts, but I would say to you, you know, when I look at my child, this may be purely maybe it's just a product of my evolutionary past, but you know, I know, in some sense, that it would be wrong, in you know, absolutely wrong, for, you know, someone to do any of the things we've just been talking about, you know, these terrible things.
Yeah, I have some sympathy with what you're saying in the sense that I can see how it would be really nice, and I would like it, if it were true that there were a supernatural creator who had certain aims for me, because it would give me a sense of purpose in my life that I wouldn't have to think about for myself, and if there was also the promise of eternal life or something else after that, it would give me a very strong sense of purpose. And there's no doubt in my mind, though it's an empirical question, that many people with the strongest purpose, and indeed many people who have done a great deal of good in this world, have been people who have been driven by their religious convictions to do so. I don't doubt any of that. You could, on the other hand, take a different approach to it, which was Nietzsche's approach, which is that you could find it liberating that we're not given any purpose from somebody else and that we have to make our own purposes. The fact that they're done on the hoof isn't, as you put it, which basically means that they're autonomous, isn't by itself a grounds for deprecating them, I think. So some people might take a different reaction to that. But whether it makes you sad or happy, let me emphasize, is quite independent of whether it's true or false. Mm.
I'm sympathetic to that, because, I mean, I would like to live in Oxford. It would make me much happier if I did, but I don't. You know, so the fact that a set of beliefs would give you a great deal of emotional comfort does not on its own indicate that those beliefs are true. But I just want to pick up on something. This may take us down a side path, but that's not always a bad thing. The comment that Arif made about if you believe that there is a supernatural purpose for your life by virtue of the fact that, you know, this world is created by God, then you don't really have to think about the purpose of your life for yourself. I think that's manifestly false. I mean, some of the greatest thinkers in the history of the world on the purpose of life and how to achieve that best, who have put in a great deal of original, careful and well-articulated thought, have been people who believe that we have that purpose because of God. Whether it's a purpose that you decide on for yourself or it's a purpose that you believe we need to discover can be equally arduous.
Yes, I'm not saying that it saves us from all thought altogether. All I'm saying is that there are some thoughts that it would save me from.
And there are some thoughts that it makes.
And there are some thoughts that it would obligate me to have as well.
So it's certainly not less intellectually rigorous.
But again, I would just emphasise that that's okay, independent of whether it's true or false.
Sure.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, we've gone some way into sort of obviously getting at the fact that, you know, you disagree with a couple of the premises.
Both premises.
I mean, there were more premises in your version of the argument, I think, that
which
you
could
sort
take
of
a very long time
to go through all of them. But I mean, do you feel that while obviously Arif has had the time and space to think through all the implications of the moral argument and things like that, that most atheists that you're aware of, Glenn, don't come to the same conclusions as Arif because they do want to.
And he admits that. He says, you know, basically it's an error theory of morality that moral claims aren't really true. And it is a minority view. And I think Arif may disagree, but I think that the reason that it's a minority view is that most atheists realize that there are some things that they ought not to do, even if they thought otherwise, and that it's possible to be mistaken about our moral duties.
I mean, for you, though, is this something that you should be making atheists aware of, that there's that they're not consistent in the way that you see Arif is consistent?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I would call all other atheists out there who hear this to look at Arif and say, look, not in the pejorative sense of you don't want to end up like Arif, but you know, is that what you are prepared for? I mean, do you think that represents the truth of the matter, that all moral claims are just false? Or do you think that maybe independent of what you think, actually there are some moral facts out there that aren't identical with natural facts? So you might believe, you know, you can harm people, but you realize that is just a descriptive fact, and you might realize, well, but I also know, in addition to that, that I ought not harm people. Now, over and above the facts of what it takes to harm people or not harm them, I know that there is one of those options that I ought to choose, and a whole raft of other things. I mean, it seems to me that the reason the moral argument is compelling is that people, including atheists, just recognize the, if not logical at least, in some other sense, the absurdity of trying to believe that the world that we live in is not inhabited by moral facts, that there's no right way to live, that you come up with any way that seems right to you, which accords with your preferences, and whatever you arrive at, well, wherever you go, there you are. You know, that's the right place to be, morally speaking. I think most of us realize that isn't true. There are actually ways that we ought to live, and some are better than others.
This might be where then someone says, and that's why atheism is bad, because then you can go off and do whatever you like because there's no moral. But we've already established.
Yeah, I mean,
that,
I haven't quite made that argument.
We're not saying it. But do you hold any belief that if atheism were the prevailing worldview, that would be bad for society, that it would have this negative underlying kind of foundation?
That's a bit of crystal ball gazing, which I'm not all that interested. But I'm not all that keen in. So it's very difficult to say. I mean, the reality is that involves an epistemological issue, namely, can atheists know what is right and wrong? And they certainly can. And the fact that they can know right from wrong certainly means that they can have strong inclinations to act on it. Now, I mean, I can produce anecdotal evidence of people who, in giving up their religious commitments, have felt a kind of moral freedom to engage in acts that most of us would regard as somehow improper or not the way to live. But once they'd cut those, you know, shackles as they may have seen them, then opportunities present themselves to, you know, do what thou wilt, as it were.
It's an interesting empirical question whether there's a connection. Well, A, whether there's an association, and B, whether there's a causal connection, and C, if so, in what direction it runs, between atheism on the one hand and what Glenn or you would call wickedness or certain forms of behaviour that people agree in calling immoral. On the other hand, in terms of the correlation, there seems to be some evidence. So there's a well-known study from 2005 in Religion and Society, which shows a correlation between the level of religious belief in you know, developed Western countries and levels of things like crime and infectious STDs and so on. So somebody might think that, so there's some evidence that there's an inverse correlation. So the more religious a country is, the more immoral behaviour goes on in it. Now, that doesn't, of course, establish that there's a causal connection between having a religious country and people behaving wickedly. It might be that there are more victims of wickedness in those countries, and so they need religion more. It doesn't actually. So we have to be honest. We can't say it establishes.
And it also only compares to.
But it is evidence, insofar as there is evidence. And what we need is not just anecdotal evidence, but statistical evidence. Insofar as there is some evidence, there's evidence that there's certainly no correlation, no positive correlation between religion established in developed Western countries on the one hand, and behaviour that you or Glenn would call moral.
Well, that's certainly not true. That's certainly not true. We know of statistical studies, for example, that have to do with, say, charitable work and giving, where there is clear evidence that religious beliefs play a pivotal role in making a difference, or at least there's a correlation between those two things. Now, I regard charitable giving as a very good thing, morally speaking. So it's not true that there's no evidence whatsoever. And moreover, I mean, if we brought a whole bunch of other factors into the previous study that was mentioned, I mean, there were two factors, you know, the degree of religiosity of this place and the level of crime in this place. What about other factors like, say, the degree of poverty in this place? I mean, a whole range of other sociological factors were simply left out of the study.
Well, if you compare, for instance, the United States to Denmark, and you compare levels of poverty in one country to the other, you'll see that levels of poverty are probably somewhat lower than in Denmark than they are in the United States, for example.
Yeah,
I mean,
but
what exactly, what it show? I mean, it doesn't show a causal correlation, I agree with that. And just like any study, there are variables that it misses out that might screen one thing off from another. You could make that criticism of any study. I think all I would say at this point is that there's some evidence in one direction. I agree with you, there's some evidence in the other direction too. And I do believe that many of the people whom I admire the most, you know, who have done so much good in the world, Desmond Tutu is the outstanding example, I think, have been religious and quite possibly have been driven by religious convictions. It doesn't follow, it doesn't even tend to show, that if society were generally atheist, then we'd all go off to...
Well, we've obviously moved into a different kind of discussion here anyway, but
yeah.
But it's interesting, you know, because in some sense the two interconnect to some degree. But we're going to have to go to another quick break here, and we'll have a chance to wrap up our thoughts as we can start to conclude this programme on the moral argument for God. That's what we've been talking about on Unbelievable today with my guests Glenn Peoples and Arif Ahmed. They're joining me again as we conclude our discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, I hope you've been keeping up with the programme today. I had to get some clarifications on the way because we have two philosophers in the studio, and things got quite deep at one point. I was splashing about. But I hope that in general that what's been said has at least sort of in some way penetrated, because I think it does touch on some of the most fundamental issues about what we believe about the universe we live in, whether there are a moral fact out there, if you like, independent of ourselves, that we ought to be living by. And if there are such facts, whether there is a moral lawgiver, it follows. That is essentially, I think, the argument that Glenn Peoples has been presenting today. Glenn is a Christian philosopher from New Zealand, joins us for a second time here on Unbelievable. Arif Ahmed, atheist philosopher from Cambridge, has been explaining why he doesn't believe we're in any way have to believe that there is a God if there are moral facts, and even whether moral facts exist, we have no conclusive proof that there is. If anything, it's the other way around. I think that a lot of people feel, Arif, that a lot of atheists might say, yes, well, I agree with Arif, that's true, that we don't have good evidence for moral facts, etc. But most atheists live like there are, in that sense, and I think this is where you've been talking about, Glenn, the fact that you feel most atheists, if you push them, will say there are moral facts, and you're seeking to show that that's inconsistent with a materialist worldview.
Yeah.
I mean, for instance, you know, Richard Dawkins spends a lot of time in The God Delusion demolishing belief in God, including, I think, he tackles at one point very briefly the moral argument, but finishes up the book saying why, if we all convert to atheism, the world will be a much better place, and using lots of moral valuations about how the world should be and this is the way we get there. So in a sense, you know, for me that just screams out there is a way the world should be. There's a standard we need to get to. You know, doing this to our children and making them, you know, have Christian upbringings and things is a terrible thing, an abusive thing. And all the time the question to me is shrieking, why? Why is that abuse? What's wrong with that? According to your, you know, philosophy, Dawkins, there is no right and wrong, ultimately, about these things. It's just kind of the way we've developed. You know, we could have, you know, had genetic mutations in our evolutionary history that took us on a different path where, you know, and we developed a different set of morals. So do you acknowledge that there's a lot of kind of double speak out there, Arif, when it comes to atheists who seem to be saying one thing but then saying something quite different on the other hand?
Good. Well, one thing I would say is that I'm not going to I'm not particularly familiar with the works of Richard Dawkins on this topic, and I wouldn't want to put words into his mouth. I'm sure he can defend myself. But can I just say a little bit about my own position on this question? I think it's an empirical question. We can't settle it a priori. Philosophers can't settle it. Nobody, I think, is yet in a position to settle it definitively, whether the world would be a better place if everybody became atheistic or not. There's some evidence that it wouldn't. So, for instance, the Soviet Union is a well-known atheist society, and the Soviet Union was a complete disaster, as everyone knows. I also have concerns about certain moral beliefs of various atheists. So I myself take the view that abortion, for example, is highly questionable, and I'm concerned that society is going down a route going towards a position where we have more and more abortions. It's considered basically a right of the mother, without reference to the child, to abort the fetus. And we're not in that position yet, but I'm concerned that we will move towards that position. And my experience has been that Christians are largely amongst people who are against it. So I myself am not of the view, definitively, it's an empirical question, which you can't settle a priori, I'm not of the view definitively that the world would be a better place if everybody became an atheist.
That wasn't quite what I was asking. I was more asking if, even if he's right and the world is a better place if we all became atheists, isn't he thereby invoking a moral standard to which we're aspiring, a better place? There is this moral standard out there which we should be aiming for. And so that's my question is,
okay, good,
whoever's
good,
right, good. They're both invoking a moral standard.
Good. Well, it may be that Dawkins is one of those atheists who accepts one of the premises of the moral argument, but not the other. So he's somebody who believes that there are moral facts, but who doesn't believe that if there are moral facts, then there is a moral lawgiver.
When I spoke to him on this, he didn't seem to. He possibly was the first time he'd thought about it, to be honest. But when I had a very brief conversation, which you can actually hear on the website, and I said, had we evolved differently, Richard, to believe that rape is okay, would that just be the way it is? Should we believe it isn't okay, in fact, do moral? And he said, well, yeah, we would. That's just what we would believe. And he seemed to dismiss the idea of moral facts. Obviously, he didn't have, that was in a very informal setting, perhaps he hadn't time to think on his feet there. But it seems he doesn't, to my mind at least, he doesn't believe in moral facts. He is consistent in that sense.
And in the God delusion, it seems that what he accounts for is the evolution of moral beliefs.
Exactly.
He never says that the moral facts have come about a certain way. He said we've come to think this way for certain reasons, but thinking about it this way is all there is to it.
But then at the same time invokes repeatedly, to my mind, moral facts.
He talks as though there were moral facts.
As though there were moral facts. And that's sort of what all I was getting at, really, is that there seems to be kind of, two hemispheres of the brain that are going on when atheists are logically committed to there not being any moral facts, but also seem to talk as though there were moral standards out there that we all should be obliged to kind of get towards, you know.
Okay, good. So if you're saying that sometimes Professor Dawkins has said that there aren't any moral facts, and at other times he says things that imply that there are moral facts, then clearly he's diachronically inconsistent. At one point he's saying one thing, and at another time he's saying something that contradicts it, and obviously then at least one of those views must be false. And you know what I think about which of those positions is false. But I wouldn't want to guess his intentions.
No, and I'm not asking
to say
you to.
This is what he must have meant.
No, absolutely.
I think it's plausible that he had a sensible and consistent view in his mind, even if it may not have been expressed ideally,
but sure.
I wouldn't want to make any further judgment on that.
You've been a fascinating person to have in, because you have the most analytical mind I've probably ever had in this studio, Arif, in terms of everything is sort of put through the filter of a sort of, you know, into a set of arguments. It's quite interesting to talk to you. Is this the way you kind of, when you're, you know, down the pub with a friend, and you're talking about matters of, you know, what's going on in politics or things, do you kind of apply the same philosophical rigour to all things that you come across, would you say?
Well, I try to, which is probably why I don't have so many friends left as I used to have. But the remaining friends are as analytically minded as I am, so we get a kind of nerdish joy in swapping arguments. I do think there's a serious point behind it, though, which is, I suppose, to do with the point of philosophy itself. I see philosophy and the point of teaching it as encouraging people to think for themselves. In a sense, that matters more than the conclusions they reach. They reach their own conclusions about things, not on the basis of what other people tell them or on the basis of tradition or authority, but they reach their own conclusions. And the point, I think, the main point of discussions like this, and any sort of philosophical discussion, is to get the audience to think of these things for themselves. An analytical argument, as well as, of course, sensory evidence, are the best instruments for doing that.
I suppose your question is, well, why should we do that?
Well, I suppose the rest of the answer was I tend to like it when people do that. I would actually invoke some sort of moral principle in there, and that it is actually morally good to do that. You know, God desires that we think his thoughts after him. God created us, in a sense, to emulate him. So I do think there is a moral point to that. But apart from that, I enjoy it immensely.
Well, it's been great having you both on. It's been fascinating to delve into this topic to some degree. Any place that either of you would point people if they want to find out more about the moral argument? Obviously, there's your blog.
There is. I mean, I have been looking. I mean, I'm in the process of preparing a book on the moral argument, and I've been looking and looking for good scholarly books that have been focused on the moral argument, and unfortunately, there just aren't that many out there. I've discovered one by Hugh Price, but that's you know, about 60 years old now.
I mean, you were both saying before we went to air that it's not talked about that much in academic circles. You don't seem to be a lot of focus on teaching or looking at the moral argument. Is there any reason you could give for that? I mean, it seems to be popular with Christian apologists. They seem, you know, Christian apologists seem to think it's quite a strong argument for the existence of God. But you don't see it out there much in just the general philosophical circles. Is there any reason?
No, why? I mean, I wouldn't want to guess at the reason. I mean, it's certainly there among the philosophers. I mean, Kant had some things to say about it, but I think it's a bit of a shame that it isn't given a bit more attention, to be perfectly honest.
I think I agree with that. I think it's an argument which is of interest, not only for its intellectual interest, but because it does actually emotionally engage people quite strongly. And especially with first-year philosophy students, that's something that you want to do.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't want to speculate as to why it's not as prominent as it could be.
Well, it's been great having you both on, anyway. I'll post a link up to your blog, Glenn, with this podcast. That's beretta-online.com. And perhaps when the book is out, you could let us know and I can point people in its direction as well.
One day.
and Arif, thank you very much for coming in. And I'll put up a link to the little profile of you at Cambridge there, and people can see some of the books you've contributed to.
Well, the point of that webpage is just so that people can get my lecture notes. So if you're really bored, you can go and have a look at it.
Well, thank you for being in on the programme today. And
thanks
both for being with me. You've been listening to conversation between Arif Ahmed, atheist philosopher from Cambridge, and Glenn Peoples, who's a Christian philosopher, all the way over from New Zealand and returning there now. You've been listening to a classic replay edition of Unbelievable, and you can get in touch with your thoughts at our show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, where you'll find further resources, the back catalogue of shows, and more ways to support the show. Thanks for being with us, and see you next time.